This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour, after a bitter election, how do we overcome deeply personal political divides?
You think Trump is a divider?
Yeah, oh yeah. He's a big promoter of hatred in my eyes.
See, and I don't feel that way at all.
We spend time with one grandmother and granddaughter as they talk through their differences. They also share advice on how to weather the holiday season with family members who have totally different views.
It's not worth dividing a family or ruining a relationship just because we don't agree on something in politics.
Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, the surge continues. Coronavirus cases and deaths hit record highs as millions of Americans gather for Thanksgiving. Then, COVID and the court. The Supreme Court blocks New York State's limits on religious gatherings, signaling the justices' move to the right. Plus, in memoriam, with over a quarter million Americans lost to COVID-19, we pay tribute to some of the remarkable lives claimed by the virus. And remembering gratitude. Even in a difficult year, it's what this Thanksgiving holiday is all about. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This Thanksgiving Day has been dramatically different amid surging COVID-19 infections. The nation recorded another 178,000 cases on Wednesday, with more than 263,000 deaths to date. In Houston today, a turkey giveaway underscored the economic pain as hundreds sought food assistance there. Many said they'd never asked for help before.
It's been very, very hard, but I'm making it. You know, I posted on Facebook instead of worrying about, you know, things that we can't do and places we can't go. Being that it's Thanksgiving, we need to be concerned with what we have.
In New York City, the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade did take place, but it was confined to a single block with no spectators and far fewer balloon handlers. Meanwhile, New York State's restriction on attendance at houses of worship was stopped short. The U.S. Supreme Court blocked it late on Wednesday night. We'll have more on that story after the news summary. President Trump, meanwhile, used a Thanksgiving event to claim again that he was robbed of an election victory. But he said he will accept the Electoral College's decision. He spoke after addressing U.S. troops via video link, and he also said he'll be campaigning in Georgia for two Republican senators facing runoffs. President-elect Biden opted against a large family gathering because of COVID, but in a video message posted today, he said, quote, better days are coming. In Ethiopia, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced he's ordered the final assault against the rebellious region of Tigray. He said the army is moving on the regional capital of Mekele after a deadline passed for Tigray's leaders to surrender. Human rights groups have raised concerns about civilians in the cities. Thousands in Tigray have reportedly already died in 3 weeks of fighting. Today in Turkey, a court found hundreds of defendants guilty of taking part in 2016's failed coup attempt. A total of 475 defendants had been on trial for 3 years. More than 300 were given life in prison. The sweeping trial was part of a government crackdown that's jailed thousands. Relatives of the convicted insisted today that many are innocent.
They were convicted today for life despite not participating in the coup attempt, despite fighting against the coup by locking themselves in a room to avoid aiding the coup efforts. They were very young when they were thrown in prison, 24 and 25. Now they're convicted for life? How do you explain this in the spirit of justice?
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accuses the cleric Fethullah Gulen of orchestrating the uprising. Gulen is based in the United States and denies any involvement. Parts of southern India, meanwhile, are underwater after a tropical cyclone smashed ashore today. It made landfall in the federal territory of Puducherry, with winds topping 80 miles an hour. Heavy rains triggered widespread flooding in the city of Chennai, home to 10 million people. The storm killed five people, blew down trees, and knocked out power. And soccer legend Diego Maradona of Argentina was mourned around the world today after his death on Wednesday. Fans in Naples, Italy, waved flags with his name and put out flowers and candles. Maradona led Napoli to 2 titles in Italy in 1987 and in 1990. And in his native Argentina, thousands lined up in Buenos Aires to see the casket. A few clashes broke out when police tried to close off access ahead of the burial this evening. Still to come, on the News Hour, the Supreme Court blocks New York State's limits on religious gatherings. We pay tribute to some of the many remarkable lives claimed by COVID-19. And some brief but spectacular takes on remembering gratitude in an unusual year.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Supreme Court overnight blocked one of the measures New York State took to combat the pandemic. Governor Andrew Cuomo had capped religious services at 10 attendees in communities where the virus risk is highest. In the 5-4 vote, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the newest justice, voted to block the restriction, along with Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. Chief Justice John Roberts sided with Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Now, the majority said houses of worship had been singled out for tougher treatment, while the dissenters said the government needs leeway when it comes to public health in a pandemic. Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal is with us now to dive into the court's order. Marcia, welcome back to the NewsHour, and thanks for being with us this Thanksgiving. We should note it's not the first time that the court has weighed in on pandemic restrictions, but what stood out to you about this latest ruling?
This ruling, Amna, had a lot of writing in it, more than 30 pages, 5 separate opinions, all showing that there were very strong feelings on both sides and also very careful analysis. One thing that struck me in particular was the concurring opinion in the majority by Justice Gorsuch, in which he really sort of accused the court of cutting loose the Constitution during a pandemic, not really caring so much about the religious liberty that was at stake here. And Chief Justice Roberts, in his dissenting opinion, he spent most of that opinion addressing Justice Gorsuch's language, in which he said they were not cutting loose the Constitution or ignoring the religious liberty. They were seriously examining and analyzing the issues in good faith. And I'll say this for Chief Justice Roberts. He's done this before when another justice has questioned the motivation of other justices on the court. And then finally, I would say the fact that the newest justice, Justice Barrett, had joined the majority, and the Chief Justice was in dissent. He was on the liberal side of the court. And I think that also shows that the conservatives on the court really don't need him. The role he played last term, in which he was basically the center, the median justice on the court, who could calibrate or moderate the shift of the court either to the left or the right, his role has been diminished. The 5 other conservative justices have that magic 5 votes if they need it. So we're going to have to wait and see, I think, where Justice Barrett goes from here. She did not write separately, so we don't know what her thoughts were other than that she agreed with the majority. But it would have been nice to hear what her thinking was in this particular case.
We don't know her thoughts on this particular case, as you mentioned, but a lot of people have been waiting to see what the impact of her presence on the court would be. And this is the first time we see some of that impact. What else does it tell us, though, specifically when it comes to pandemic restrictions and the fact that the court may have to consider more of these restrictions at this time?
Well, they already have pending at least 2 other applications for injunctions by religious institutions. And I will point out that the 2 that the court ruled on last night, I believe they actually were filed after Justice Barrett's confirmation. And so the fact that others are coming in now, I think it shows that they feel they have a more sympathetic court in terms of the religious liberty issues that they're bringing. And I think the court, though, is going to be weighing what is at stake when it comes, what rights are at stake when it comes to the restrictions that the governors are imposing here. It may not always be religious liberty. It could be free speech. We just have to wait and see now that the court has a 6-3 conservative majority where the court's going to go. I'm sure there will be more applications for injunctions.
That is Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal joining us tonight. Thanks so much for being with us, Marcia, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thanks. Same to you. Take care.
And now for a public health view on that Supreme Court decision, we turn to Dr. Dara Kass. She's an associate professor of emergency medicine at Columbia University Medical Center and a medical contributor for Yahoo News. She joins me now from New York. Dr. Kass, welcome back to the NewsHour. Happy Thanksgiving, and thank you for making the time. When you look at that Supreme Court decision from a public health perspective, what do you worry that the impact of that might be?
So my worry is it's going to really remove our ability to make decisions in a very targeted way to the environments that we think are really where the virus spreads. We probably think we can keep 80% of businesses open if we only target the places that we think the virus is spreading. And unfortunately, there's evidence that within houses of worship, especially when they're at capacity without masks, we've seen super spreader events and really unrelenting spread of this virus. So the problem with this case for me is that it removes the ability of local governance, governors and mayors, to make decisions that impact their community as little as possible while protecting their citizens from this virus.
And Dr. Kass, some of the dissenters on the Supreme Court said that public health experts need that leeway to make decisions. But the majority of the justices said, even in a pandemic, you can't treat businesses and groups differently. You can't leave liquor stores and bike shops open, for example, and then close houses of worship. What do you say to that?
I would say that our local leaders and our public health officials are saying to treat different businesses and different gathering spaces differently. We know there are certain environments, probably less than 20% of all gathering spaces, that are unsafe in this pandemic, but most are safe. Places like schools are probably better off than places like bars. And unfortunately, houses of worship spread the virus more like bars than they do like schools, and we need to treat each space in accordance of its effect on this pandemic, not necessarily about what the justices want it to be.
In the few seconds we have left, I should ask you, people are considering on this Thanksgiving holiday if they should gather tonight, how they should gather tonight. If you had a few words of advice for people out there as they weigh that decision, what would they be?
I would say to think of this moment instead of individual freedom, but collective responsibility, the opportunity for all of us to act as one unit to protect each other. And that if your house of worship or your family is gathering in a way that you think isn't safe, just don't go. Wait it out a few more months. Protect your local family and your community as best as you can, because we're going to get to the other side of this pandemic very, very soon. Help is on the way. We just need to get there.
That is Dr. Dara Kass, emergency medicine associate professor in New York and Yahoo News medical contributor. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Have a great holiday, okay?
On this Thanksgiving Day, tens of thousands of our friends and neighbors have one less person at the table. Over 250,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus this year. Every Friday since March, the NewsHour's brought you a short segment, In Memoriam, as a way to honor some of those whose lives were cut short. As part of that process, families, friends, and colleagues, in the midst of their own grieving, have generously shared with us favorite memories and family pictures and heartwarming videos of the loved one they lost, so that we could then put names and faces and stories to this enormous tragedy. And so tonight, we want to devote considerable time, not just to note the undeniable impact COVID-19 has had on our country, but also to express our gratitude to all those who shared their time and their memories with us this year so we could help remember those who died. Here now is Judy Woodruff with an extended look back at some of the Americans we've lost so far to the COVID-19 pandemic.
84-year-old Mary Roman overcame childhood polio to win some 350 track and field medals, including at the Senior Olympics. When she wasn't on the track, she was on the sidelines, cheering on her five boys and grandchildren in the same sport. Roman was a local celebrity in Norwalk, Connecticut, not just for her athleticism, but for her decades-long career as a city clerk. Aldo Bazzarelli perfected each item on his namesake restaurant's menu, from butchering his own meats to preparing his homemade marinara sauce. Raised in southern Italy, he was a born entrepreneur. He ran a barber shop as a child before immigrating to the United States in 1968. In his nearly 50 years running Bazzarelli's, he never fired an employee. The 73-year-old is remembered for his big heart, especially when it came to his five grandchildren. April Dunn of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was a driven advocate for those with disabilities. Denied a high school diploma of her own, April helped state lawmakers pass a bill that allowed students with disabilities to receive their degrees and went on to work closely with the governor. Kind, outgoing, sociable, April was a great source of pride for her family. She was just 33. Sean Boynes, once a captain in the U.S. Air Force, was a pharmacist dedicated to serving his Maryland clients. Sean received 3 degrees from Howard University, where he played football, mentored pharmacy students, and married his bride, Nicole, on campus. Funny and joyful, it was Sean's smile that caught Nicole's heart. For Sierra and Gabrielle, their father was their comforter and cheerleader. He was 46 years old. Vincent Leonti, a violist with the New York Metropolitan Opera for 33 years, was known for his quiet confidence, humility, and kindness. Vincent's first teacher was his father, Victor, who conducted the Westchester Youth Symphony Orchestra before passing the baton to Vincent in 1997. Vincent met his wife, Kristen, in the Met cafeteria, and their family grew by one, Nicholas. Judy Wilson Griffin dedicated her life to helping high-risk mothers and babies as a perinatal nurse specialist in St. Louis, Missouri. An educator and a leader, Judy addressed racial disparities in maternal health care and access to care. To her colleagues and patients, she was like a best friend, a sister, funny, humble, and gracious. Judy also served in the U.S. Navy as a nurse. She was 63. Tommy Lopez was known to Seattleites as the smiling face behind this family-owned food truck for almost 2 decades. Born in Mexico, the father of 5 served in the military there before immigrating to the U.S. when he was 24. He made national headlines in 2017 for selling tacos to hungry drivers stranded in a massive interstate traffic jam. He was 44 years old. 74-year-old Wayne Reese Sr. was a quiet man anywhere but on the football field. He coached and mentored Louisiana high school football players for 5 decades. Some went on to play in the NFL, including Hall of Famer Marshall Faulk. From driving them to 6 a.m. practice and helping hundreds secure college scholarships, his family says his shoulders were broad from always carrying the worries of others. Captain Douglas Hickok was a member of the New Jersey National Guard Medical Unit, specializing in emergency medicine. Described by his family as fearless, Hickok had prepared to help with the pandemic spread before he was infected. Off duty, the 57-year-old was an avid outdoorsman, grill master, and father of 2. A third-generation service member, Captain Hickok was the U.S. military's first loss to the pandemic. Robin Hardy became a pastor when she was 25 years old and served as vice president of her church in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Her children remember a unifier, both in church and as the founder of a mentorship program for girls, where they say she reached more than 1,000 women and did so in style. Hardy was 56 years old. Pediatric neurosurgeon Dr. James Goodrich of New York's Montefiore Medical Center garnered international acclaim for successfully separating 10 twins conjoined at the head and advising dozens of other such surgeries. Outside the operating room, the 73-year-old was a bonsai tree enthusiast. He had a library of rare antique medical books and was an avid player of the Australian Aboriginal instrument, the didgeridoo. His friends dubbed him the most interesting man in the world. Vitalina Williams loved gardening and cooking with her husband in Salem, Massachusetts, when she wasn't working her two jobs at the local grocery store and Walmart. Bold and principled, Williams was known as the CEO and CFO of her family. She came to the United States from Guatemala in the 1990s and spoke to her family there on the phone every day. She was 59 years old. 61-year-old Quincy Simpson, a correctional officer at New York's Rikers Island, was known for his calm demeanor, great sense of humor, and hard work ethic. When he contracted COVID-19, Quincy called in sick for only the second time in his 18 years on the job. He was a mentor to the basketball players he coached, neighborhood school kids, and his 6-year-old son, Aiden. Karen Ketcher dedicated her career to serving Native American tribes in her home state of Oklahoma and across the country. Karen loved to sew, including memorable prom and wedding dresses, and spent all of her free time with her family, her grandkids, and great-grandkids. In Tahlequah's Cherokee Nation, she was known as everyone's Granny Karen for loving everyone in the community like they were her own. She was 70 years old.
I didn't know I was 4 feet from the atomic bomb.
Philip Kahn always carried his military photos with him so he could tell his story. An Air Force co-pilot in World War II, Kahn was in the Battle of Iwo Jima and helped take aerial surveys of the damage wrought by the atomic bombs. After the war, he settled in New York and was an electrical foreman on the construction of the World Trade Center. More devastating than the war, Philip often said, was the Spanish flu pandemic, which killed his twin brother in infancy. Philip was 100 years old. Lisa Dawn Robinson never went anywhere without a set of drumsticks. Known to fans as Lady Rhythm, the Philadelphia-born drummer toured the world with soul singer Billy Paul and played with many more artists, including Pink. Lisa was a go-to source for advice for her two sisters and nieces, who describe her as witty, charming, and a good listener. She was 55 years old. For activist Josepha Eyer, her desire to help displaced refugees was largely inspired by her upbringing in Nazi-occupied Holland. In 1989, Josepha, or Josie, founded the Women's Bean Project in Denver, Colorado, to create long-term solutions for homeless women through work and counseling. Over the years, she welcomed people in need into her own family. She was active and tenacious, an inspiration to her children and grandchildren. Josie was 89 years old. 50-year-old Bobby Pinn was known for his blue hair and infectious energy. Photography and filmmaking took Bobby around the world. He took photos at Burning Man festivals and filmed in Nepal and India, making countless friends along the way. A perfectionist, Bobby excelled in more than just art. He was also a scuba diver, completing over 150 dives. Last year, he made one special trip to Cambodia, where he was born. Bobby's family fled the country during the Pol Pot dictatorship when he was 5 years old. Fashionable, talented, and full of curiosity, Kiati Jackson Harpool lit up every room, from political fundraisers to girls' nights with friends. A Baltimore native, Kiati worked as a social worker for the homeless before launching her dream business, Kiati's Charm City Chocolates, inspired by her father's mobile candy truck. She was 51 years old. Valentina Blackhorse dreamed of one day leading Navajo Nation. Born and raised in Kayenta, Arizona, Valentina participated in Native American pageants, where she demonstrated her deep knowledge and affinity for Navajo culture, skills, and language. Quiet, warm, and caring, Valentina was dedicated to passing on her culture to younger generations, including her one-year-old daughter. She was just 28 years old. Arlene Saunders was as captivating as her soprano opera voice. Born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, Arlene spent most of her career in Germany, performing with the Hamburg State Opera on stage and on television. She would go on to sing at the biggest opera house in the world, the Met. Down to earth and elegant, Arlene moved to New York in 1986, where she married the man she loved to dance and sing with, Raymond Raskin. Arlene was 89 years old. Abdel Fattah Abidrabo was often the first person at his Canton, Michigan mosque, arriving at 4 in the morning to lead the sunrise prayer. A Palestinian immigrant, Abe arrived in the U.S. in the 1970s with close to nothing. Devoted, tireless, and generous, he worked overtime and on holidays to build his import-export business, always with a smile on his face. His 6 children say he gave them the American dream. He was 65 years old. Haley Herrera was nurturing and compassionate, the first person her friends called for comfort and advice. The 25-year-old Bronx native was working to become a therapist. She helped care for people with mental illnesses and earned a master's degree in marriage and family therapy. Her mom says she was a ball of energy and a joy to be around. Haley loved throwing themed parties and making memories with her friends and family. Ralph Pabon had an eye for fashion and a spirit of adventure. Both came through in the bridal gowns he designed in New York City. When his beloved mother remarried in 2014, Ralph walked her down the aisle. She wore the wedding dress he designed. Gregarious and fun, Ralph loved that his most recent work as a flight attendant allowed him to explore the world. He was 51 years old. 82-year-old Patrick Petit's family dubbed him the family philosopher, a nod to his ability to listen and offer advice. After serving in the Navy, he became a community organizer during the Civil Rights Movement, taught sociology at a university in Minneapolis, and raised 3 children. His last words were a message to his grandkids: be happy, be kind, and keep learning. Ann Sullivan brought cartoons to life as a painter for animation studios, including Disney and Hanna-Barbera. Among the characters she helped create were the Smurfs. The North Dakota native loved to paint landscapes of the California coast and portraits of her children and grandchildren. Her daughter says Ann exuded positivity and that when she laughed, she did so with her whole body. Ann was 91 years old. Dosha Joy was colorful, his friends say. He had a smile and energy that could brighten a dark room. After aging out of foster care, Dosha, or DJ, fought to better the system, particularly for foster kids in the LGBTQ community. It was a mission that took him from his home state of Wisconsin to advocate on Capitol Hill. DJ was also a certified nursing assistant, studying to become a registered nurse. He was 28 years old. Hatsy Yasukochi was the heart of her family-run bakery in San Francisco. She knew her customers by name and often their orders by heart. A proud mother and grandmother, Hatsy displayed family photos on the bakery walls and loved taking silly Snapchats with her 5 grandchildren. As a young girl, Hatsy's family was imprisoned in internment camps during the Second World War. Her daughters say that experience gave her the perseverance she would later rely on to battle cancer. She was 80 years old. Susan Rokas was a beloved elementary school teacher in Loudoun County, Virginia, for almost five decades. A woman of faith, friends say Susan was respectful and truthful, qualities she instilled in her young students. She was particularly skilled at helping children overcome challenges with reading through empathy and positivity. Susan also loved tea time with friends, tennis, and fashion. She was 73 years old. Peggy Powell was often referred to as the unofficial mayor of Evanston, Illinois. For 37 years, he ran Heckey's Barbecue. Their famous sauce was created by him and his parents. Heckey employed kids from all walks of life, and that commitment extended beyond his restaurant to his social work, providing opportunities for struggling youth. The 71-year-old was also a loving father of seven. Anyone who knew Loretta Dionisio could see she was tough. Loretta fled martial law in the Philippines in her early 20s and rose to become a graphic designer and creative director in Orlando, Florida. A cancer survivor, she traveled the world with her husband of nearly 50 years. The pair were inseparable. Around her family, Loretta's toughness melted away. They say she was the sweetest person. Loretta was 68 years old. 92-year-old Theodore Gaffney was a researcher and documentarian who brought great curiosity to his work. After serving in the U.S. Army following World War II, Theodore studied photography under the GI Bill. The Washington, D.C. native was one of the first African Americans to photograph inside the White House. In 1961, he documented the Freedom Riders as they traveled through the South to fight segregation. Theodore later moved to Brazil to study the African diaspora. It was there that he met his wife, Maria. Jess Begay Sr. of the Navajo Nation was a long-haul trucker who transported everything from explosives to milk. He taught others how to drive commercially, including his own daughter, Leslyn. She said her dad was humble and always open to learning more. He still referred to himself as a rookie, even as a 25-year veteran in the trucking industry. His family described Jess as dedicated, prayerful, and loving. He was 73 years old. Mary Wilson had a way with animals. She was 23 when she started working at the Maryland Zoo and went on to become the first Black woman to be promoted to senior zookeeper. Mary was a mother figure to many, including an orphan gorilla named Sylvia. Mary continued to visit Sylvia even after she left the Maryland Zoo. Sylvia always remembered her. Mary's dedication to her work inspired her daughter, Sharon, to become a zookeeper too. Mary was 83. Rene Chavez had big dreams and an active imagination, said his wife, Annette. Passionate about the animated He-Man series from the 80s, Rene launched a successful podcast called Nerds on a Couch, where he and his friends discussed, debated, and reviewed comics. Rene even drafted his own sci-fi stories.
Hello, everybody. Rene from Nerds on the Couch here.
As a high school English teacher in El Paso, Rene would often loan his comics to students to encourage them to read more. Rene was 45 years old. Reverend Vicki Gibbs' final sermon at her Houston church was an impassioned call to action on coronavirus relief and racial injustice.
Be the bridge to equality by demanding and voting in change.
Spreading love and fighting for justice, these were Vicki's callings, said her wife, Cassandra, whether that meant attending protests or cooking meals for friends in need. She had a special bond with her grandson, who she nicknamed Boo. Together, they listened on repeat to My Cherie Amour by Stevie Wonder. Vicki was 57. N.S. Ramamurthy, or Rama to those who knew him, was a pioneering research scientist at Stony Brook School of Dental Medicine. The work of his team led to important discoveries in oral health and antibiotics. Born in South India, and before settling in New York, Rama moved to Canada in 1966, where he met his wife of nearly 50 years, Sharon, in a biochemistry class. Described as gregarious with a passion for South Asian arts, Rama was devoted to his students and his family, including two daughters and five grandchildren. Rama was 80 years old. Cynthia Tilley's friends joked her hair was as big as her heart. The former nurse was constantly organizing community fundraisers and charity events in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Christmas was her favorite holiday. She spoiled everyone around her, from her two children to her two granddaughters, who called her Gigi. At 61, Cynthia was still the star of any dance floor, especially when performing the shag. Until she was 7 years old, Tatiana Moore barely spoke, but she went on to become a talented singer in her Buffalo, New York theater group. Tatiana loved working with children. She ran a before and after school program, mentored young performers, and helped care for kids with special needs. Tatiana was the first in her family to graduate college and planned to go back to school to become a social worker. Her kind, patient demeanor earned her the nickname the Peacekeeper. Tatiana was 22 years old. Farida Kadwani was a lifelong educator, teaching kids at New York public schools for 20 years. After moving to the Bronx from Mumbai, India in 1984, Farida volunteered her time as a tutor for neighborhood kids, who said she was a constant guidance. Her daughter said she was outgoing and the life of the party, and those who met her felt like they had known her for years. Farida was 75. Jennifer Robin Arnold was creative, fun, and a little outrageous. A friend called her a live wire. Jennifer was born into a family of dancers in New York City. In her 20s, she toured through Europe and South America as a professional dancer. She went on to help make costumes and work backstage on Broadway's Phantom of the Opera as a dresser for more than 30 years. A lover of Coney Island, Jennifer was 67 years old. After long days working as a registered nurse, Joshua Obrup often retreated to the happiest place on earth, Disneyland. His photographs of the park, posted on Instagram under the account Disneyland Panda, earned him more than 20,000 followers. As a child in Gardena, California, Josh begged his parents for a sister. He eventually got his wish in Jasmine. They were 8 years apart, but inseparable. Josh was 29 years old. 48-year-old Abraham Martin Vega of Texas will be remembered as a peacemaker, his daughter Corey said. At the age of 19, Abraham entered law enforcement and worked his way up to being elected Linn County Sheriff in 2016. Corey said that anyone who came in contact with her father instantly felt his affection, whether at Sunday church services or the grocery store. A husband, father, and grandfather, Abraham's family was his pride and joy. Lillian Tourette was a fighter, her daughter said. Born in Guatemala, Lillian came to the United States at 22 years old. Life wasn't easy. She woke up at 3 a.m. to start working, often taking on two or more jobs to support her two children. For 20 years, she worked in a Los Angeles County middle school cafeteria. Beloved by the teachers and students for her cheerfulness, Lillian was 54 years old. 62-year-old James Mahoney was described by his sister as a supportive father of three and a caring doctor. He went by Charlie, and when his dream to play professional baseball didn't pan out, he turned to medicine. Charlie spent more than three decades serving his students and patients in Brooklyn, most recently as a critical care specialist for two hospitals. His sister said Charlie was quiet growing up, but was outgoing with his patients. Larry Kelly taught American government to high school seniors in Miami for 32 years. When they turned 18, he made sure every student registered to vote. A lover of books and learning, Larry never wanted to leave the classroom. He taught summer school and led field trips to the courthouse in Washington, D.C. When he eventually retired, the 78-year-old worked at the local library. Quiet, but witty and hilarious to those who knew him best, Larry loved cheering on his home teams in New Orleans with his daughters and granddaughters. Nursing was more than a job for 62-year-old Patricia Edwards. She wore old-fashioned scrubs to the intensive care unit in Greenville, South Carolina, where she worked. Nurse Pat was one of the first in line to treat COVID patients. She was fearless, even when battling cancer herself, and made those around her feel safe, her daughter said. Thanksgiving was Pat's favorite holiday. She spent the day in the kitchen, blasting old school R&B with her five children and 13 grandchildren. Growing up in El Salvador, Jose Mardoqueo Reyes was fascinated by radio. He went on to become a radio show host in Washington, D.C., where he combined his love for broadcast and sports. Jose often announced local games for his Spanish-speaking listeners. His daughter described Jose's personality as infectious, straightforward, and funny. A beloved husband, father to five, and grandfather, Jose was 54 years old. Robert Mauta spent 20 years as a truck driver before his life was turned upside down. After suffering a stroke in his 40s, the Army veteran moved next door to his daughter in Austin, Texas, where he made a career out of the highlight of his day, walking his grandchildren to school. For the next 17 years, as a crossing guard, he made sure everyone got to elementary school safely. Family was everything to Robert, his daughter said. The 67-year-old never missed his grandkids' baseball games or cheerleading meets. Margie Kidd was in her 40s when she went back to school to become a teacher. She had a gift for holding the attention of her kindergartners and first graders in Ridgeland, South Carolina, and regularly said that learning should always be fun. She'd wake up early by 6 a.m. each day and send silly memes to her daughters and grandchildren, along with messages of love and advice.
Just remember what I taught you to become a better woman. You must believe in yourself, you must do better, and you will must help others.
Margie was 71 years old. Growing up in Lafayette, New York, Adeline Fagan loved to pretend she was a doctor. Fast forward to medical school, the sociable student made it a point to meet all 144 of her classmates. She traveled to Haiti on outreach trips and, driven by her love for babies, surgery, and education, became an OBGYN resident in Houston. One of four girls, her parents said that Adeline was the mischief maker and had a silly streak. A best friend to her sisters, Adeline was 28 years old. Mario Aranda's life work was to empower people, his family said. Raised Mormon in Chihuahua, Mexico, Mario immigrated to Utah in 1959, where he met his wife of three decades. His work in linguistics then took him to Chicago, where he advocated for Latinos and promoted bilingual education. His marriage ended in the 1990s, and in Berkeley, California, Mario found love a second time. He and his partner had 20 years together. The spiritual father of seven enjoyed hiking, swimming, meditating, and like his mom, he was a voracious reader. Mario was 79. Those who knew 69-year-old David D. Swart Sr. described him as a simple man who worked hard every day for his family and friends. A lifelong resident of upstate New York, he served as a lieutenant and 30-year veteran of the Amsterdam Fire Department. When he wasn't putting out fires, he was making hot dogs at his restaurant, Dave's Dogs, and devoting time to his family. His son said Dave loved big and was a first responder in both work and spirit, always showing up for those in need. Salutacion Solon Fontanilla grew up in the Philippines wanting to go into medicine. In 1993, Salutacion, or Sally, moved to California to work in nursing. For more than two decades, Sally was a bedside nurse at St. Mary Medical Center, where her husband also worked. The two were high school friends in the Philippines and married in 2000. Described by her husband as sweet and laid back, Sally was 51 years old. Jim Goulding served as a United Methodist chaplain, professor, and dean over his three decades at McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois. Jim continued teaching even in retirement. After the 9/11 attacks, he created courses on Islam to foster dialogue and understanding of the religion in Madison, Wisconsin. Jim also led Sunday school classes and enjoyed traveling with his wife of 51 years. A beloved father and grandfather, Jim was 83 years old. Emergency room doctor Juan Fitz practiced medicine for 34 years. He cared for his patients at his hospital in Lubbock, Texas, like they were family, said his daughter. A gregarious jokester, his daughter said her dad's laughter would fill a room and that he was the type of person who would give you the shirt off his back. Despite his hectic schedule, Juan, a father and grandfather, always managed to make time for his family from softball games to ski trips. Juan was 67 years old. 17-year-old Elvia Ramirez, or Rose to friends, had big plans for life after high school, among them college, an engagement to her longtime boyfriend, and a trip to Disneyland with her younger siblings. Curious and creative, Rose loved learning about her family's Native American history and culture in North Dakota, and spent lots of her free time drawing. She also had a silly side on full display on her social media, where she enlisted her brothers, sisters, and friends in dances and lip syncs. Ray and Joan Connery first met in the summer of 1953.
There I was on Craigville Beach in Hyannis, minding my own business with four of my friends, just having a grand time.
They were exciting looking women.
What made you draw to me?
You look like you had money.
Ray served in the Navy during the Second World War. When he returned, he became a Rhode Island state trooper. Joan was a dietitian. They married within a year of meeting and raised five children together. Both had a passion for bettering the community. Joan started a literacy program at the Providence Hospital and advocated for better union contracts and teacher pay. Ray served 10 years on the town council. They traveled the world together, but were equally happy at home, hosting dinners with their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They passed within 22 days of each other, both 93 years old.
And we are so grateful to everyone who shared those stories with us this year. Our thoughts are with you and your families. Now, throughout the pandemic, our brief but spectacular segments have introduced us to a number of wonderful and inspiring people, many on the front lines fighting this virus. Tonight, we return to them as they share with us what they're especially grateful for this year.
I am an internal medicine resident at a hospital in New York City.
I'm the co-founder of the AIDS Memorial Quilt, and I'm working these days on making masks.
We are over-the-road truck drivers.
and we deliver groceries to all lower 48 states.
I work in Fort Gaines, Georgia, Clay County, and I was the only doctor here for 15 years.
I'm the only female troubleshooter that ComEd ever had in 100-year history.
I'm a nurse, an artist, a dancer. Over the last 8 months, I've received a lot of hope from the humanity that I experience on a daily basis.
My mother is a certified nurse's assistant at a veterans home in Queens. Her resilience and grit, I've tried to channel that myself.
It's been a really isolating year, and I must say I'm thankful for Zoom. It's been a great opportunity to reach out to people by Zoom in other ways that I haven't seen in years. I really feel my own mortality these days. And that can be a sad thing, but it can also be a life-affirming thing. You never know how much time you have, and you need to use every minute of it. And this year has been a reminder of that over and over and over.
In August, I started the Chinatown Mural Project, and I'm using art for recovery. If everybody does their own little part, we have a chance to survive here.
When people call 911, they don't often consider that we are a human on the other end of the line. No matter if it's just a noise complaint or somebody is having a heart attack, like, we care.
Under the circumstances of the pandemic, the demand for palliative care skills and abilities has risen exponentially. What gives me hope is the recognition of the essentials in life, and the essentials are human connection.
I'd like to be hopeful and thankful that at this time of year that we can put our differences aside and put the gauntlets down and love each other and take care of each other and help each other get through.
The pandemic, you know, as horrific as it is, it also has improved healthcare in some ways. We're doing much, much more virtual work. Those changes are going to last forever.
Malawi is one of the poorest countries in the world. I'm truly, truly grateful for the people that continued to pour their hearts and support the work that we do. Although the world remained closed, their hearts remained open.
Two of the bigger challenges for me personally this year were contracting COVID-19 and then being evacuated due to the California wildfires where I live. You know, when we evacuated, it was like, just leave. And it became clear like how few things that I own are actually important to me. Nothing else really mattered except for my relationships.
I'm so incredibly grateful for all of my colleagues, for every nurse, physician, social worker, chaplain, nursing assistant. You know, the nurse will call the family and say, we think it's going to be soon. You know, we're so sorry, but your father's dying. And you know, the daughter will say, oh, you know, my dad, you know, he loved to read scripture, or he loved music, or I always thought I would be there to hold his hand. And, you know, it makes me so tearful, but, you know, nurses are saying, I'll go be the daughter. There's thousands of stories around this country of nurses that went back in that room, not just as a nurse, but as a family member.
The most challenging part of the last 8 months for me is definitely just getting used to these masks and just trying to keep from contracting this disease and bringing it home. I'm trying to protect my son, my 13-year-old son now. He was diagnosed last year with Hodgkin's lymphoma. He is in remission right now, so I want to keep him there. Sometimes I do get down, and I just like, enough is enough. But I just tell myself, you know what? I got my children looking at me and depending on me, and I can't give up. My name is Savoya Taylor.
My name is Kat Zwick.
My name is Gertrude Kabwazi.
My name is Dr. Karen Kinsel.
I'm Ron Drew.
And I'm Shantae Drew.
My name is Bridget Rhodes.
Colin Chan.
Tara Reinders.
Shamika Simonis.
I'm Mike Smith.
My name is Diane Meyer, and this is my brief but spectacular take on seeing patients as people.
On the compassionate care provided by nurses during COVID.
On resilience.
On surviving COVID.
On courage.
And that is the News Hour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. From all of us at the PBS NewsHour, we're wishing you and yours a happy and a safe Thanksgiving. Thank you. We'll see you soon.